From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about the life and work of Robin Williams, who died in 2014. And most of us were shocked when we heard the news. His career had declined, but Williams still seemed brimming with energy. The writer Dave Itzkoff has a new book that explores Williams' life and inspirations and what his public persona can tell us about the inner life he mostly kept to himself. In just a moment.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the news broke that Robin Williams had died, had committed suicide by hanging himself with a belt in 2014, people had similar reactions. David Letterman said his death was the diametric opposite of what his life was like. It seemed like no one would ever suffocate that energy, he said. But what we've come to know is that Williams had been struggling with addiction and depression, and in those last months, a baffling physical condition that affected his motor skills and his memory and his mental health. In a new book about Robin Williams, Dave Itzkoff writes that the scene of Williams' suicide, which he orchestrated and implemented alone, revealed nothing about why he had done it. But even to his closest friends, there was always some part of his inner life he wasn't willing to disclose. Today in the program, Dave Itzkoff is joining us to talk about Robin Williams. His book is called Robin. Itzkoff is a culture reporter for The New York Times, and he joined us from the NPR studios in New York. Itzkoff first talked to Williams back in 2009 for a story he was writing, and as happened with a lot of people who met him, the persona turned out to be different from the real guy.
Of course, all of my expectations were informed by how he was as a performer, which was high energy and relentless and nonstop and wildly inventive, all of those things. And I think the very first conversation that I had with him was for a piece I was writing about Bobcat Goldthwait and his film World's Greatest Dad, which Robin starred in. And so in that case, it was just a telephone conversation between myself and Robin. And at times he was so quiet and soft-spoken, I almost had to worry whether or not my telephone recorder was picking him up.
Right.
Not that he was shy or retreating, but just very subdued and, you know, very, totally thoughtful, but very even tones and really pleasant. And so if as an interviewer or the other participant in that conversation, I felt any pressure or anxiety about what it would be, all of that was alleviated by how kind and thoughtfully he conducted himself.
He learned that you had this mutual interest in comics and collectibles. And so he invites you. I mean, and you figure it's just kind of a gesture from a celebrity that you get this all the time that turned out to be real. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. That came out of working on the full-length profile of Robin. And that was part of, you know, one night we were in a hotel room in, like, Buckhead, right outside of Atlanta, you know, the penthouse suite that Robin got when he was in town. And we're just chit-chatting about our cultural tastes. And we were both into comic books, different comic books. I was more like a superhero geek, and he was into Japanese manga and some more far-out stuff. But we both liked to shop at the same store in New York, and he offered me that sort of invitation. And I said, yeah, sure, as you say, not really ever thinking that he'd follow through on that. And then later that fall, I got a call from him. It was like a Saturday saying, you know, do you want to meet up there? And of course I did. I mean, I wasn't going to resist that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like he was trying to butter me up for the piece. That encounter was not supplying me with more material for the story. It wasn't like he was moving heaven and earth for me, but he knew that it was something that I would find special and that I would enjoy. And he knew that it was something that he could do rather easily, that if he just gave up a little bit of his own time, and something he was going to do already, apparently, that it would make me really happy and give me a lot of pleasure. And that, I thought, said a lot about who he was, that he tried to do that on different scales for a lot of people, that he always wanted to make sure, I think, that people got some portion of the Robin Williams experience, whatever that was and whatever those people hoped it would be. But I think also when you think about the totality of those kinds of transactions over a lifetime, maybe they were just small little increments here and there, but they really add up. And I think it took a lot from him emotionally and psychically in a lot of ways.
There's this story you tell, and it seems like in some ways it's kind of a theme that I gathered about his life. There's this experience you have where I think you go backstage and he's very open, but there's this one thing that's kind of off limits. That's his pre-show ritual, that he's that no one really is allowed to interrupt Robin for this 35, 45 minutes before he goes on. And in the book, you wonder whether he's meditating, maybe he's just burning off energy, or if, and this is how you put it, or if he just wanted to create a mystique about himself and keep some portion of his process secret. And it seems like that's a theme here. Don't you think that
because no one really
knew what was real and whether he was keeping something to himself always?
No, I mean, I certainly wasn't trying to be particularly subtle about that metaphor, that idea of, kind of sealing himself off in that room for a little while and not letting anybody else in. And that every person I spoke to, and this includes one of his former wives, one of his sons, they all felt like, as much as they got of him and as intimately as they all knew him, everybody felt like there was a facet of him, and it was different for different people what that facet was, but some facet of him that they didn't get, that he held back or kept private or held off from them. I'll give you an example. I mean, both Valerie Velarde, who was Robin's first wife, and Pam Dauber, who, of course, was his co-star on Mork and Mindy, they each tell stories of the first time that they met him. And in those encounters, Robin puts on a kind of a phony accent.
Right.
That for Valerie, he pretends that he's a Frenchman. And they meet at a bar and they go out into the night in San Francisco. They're driving around. And the whole night, Valerie thinks that he's French until later, and she realizes, oh, he's putting me on. Or when he meets Pam Dauber at the first photo shoot for Mork and Mindy, and he puts on a Russian accent, and Pam goes back to her makeup trailer, and she's like, is he Russian? It's partly to, you know, entertain people. It's to make them laugh and get comfortable with them. But it's also, I thought it was a little bit of a defense mechanism on Robin's part, that if he were to reveal himself immediately to these people, there's a chance that maybe they would reject him. Maybe they wouldn't like him. Yeah. And that would have been really devastating to him. He took those things really deeply to heart all through his life.
Mm. You began your book after he had died. And I'm wondering, did part of you hope that you might discover that thing that he was keeping secret?
I didn't think of it quite that way, that there was, you know, a sort of a great mystery, or, you know, to put it in the terms of the Fisher King, a holy grail, to be found. I just, you know, from my past encounters with him and the experience of writing about him, I did feel like I just had so much more to say about him. I felt like his life would be a really rich one on the one hand, and on the other, I felt like there were a lot of, this came immediately out of just the obituary articles and things that were being written about him posthumously, a lot of urban myths about him that had already seemed to be codifying things that I felt like a fuller exploration of his life would hopefully help to undo or to clarify, to and that also seeing the interweaving or the interaction between his life and his work would shed a lot of light on why he chose the parts that he did, why they were all really important to him, and how much richness there was in performances and work that I think was a little underappreciated.
Yeah. Let's talk about his early life. One of the things that you mention is how enthralled, that's the word you use, he is by his parents. Captivated by their moods, enamored of his mother, also deeply respectful of his father, but his mother and father are completely different people in many ways, and they seem to have given him two different kinds of things. Yeah, talk a little bit about his folks.
Sure, sure. I mean, I found them to be fascinating characters, people in their own right. That his father, on the one hand, was a wealthy Midwest industrialist, a World War II veteran, and then became an executive for Ford Motor Company, and a little bit of a button-down man, mostly pretty serious. I think in all the ways that you might imagine, particularly as the father of an actor and a comedian, somebody who didn't give his approval easily. Yeah. And yet his mother was this really exciting, kind of vivacious woman, a Southern kind of debutante, and descended from, I mean, this is literally true, her great-grandfather was a former Civil War hero and then a governor and senator from Mississippi. And so just even in the meeting of those two people, I mean, they themselves were so kind of different and contrasting. And there's sort of a lot of sparks flying there. And obviously the son that they are going to produce together is going to have both of those sides, a really outgoing side and then a very inward, introspective side. And so those are the kind – I mean, those are the – that's what Robin, I think, was drawn to about them. And just, of course, in a very traditional, parent-child relationship, of course you want that kind of parental approval and affirmation. And I think it was hard for him to come by from both parents because his dad, not only because of the dad's kind of personality traits, but also because he traveled so much for his work and just often wasn't around. And his mother was very deeply busy in, the social activity of wherever they were living at the time. The family moved a lot between Illinois and Michigan because of, the needs of the auto industry. And his mother, would be organizing, high teas and, dinners for the father. And so both of them, didn't really, Robin couldn't get exactly what he needed from them at all times. And so I think that made him, kind of retreat into himself.
He recognized, Robin did, that his father, that alcohol could get his father to lower his protective shells. And you tell about these moments he'd have a few drinks. And when they, one of the things they shared, at least maybe this was a moment, was this affection for Jack Parr. And this was one of the times he was allowed to stay up late.
Yeah, that specifically if Jonathan Winters was on Jack Parr, which I thought was really interesting, that those were the moments that the father and son would be sitting side by side watching the TV. And Winters, also had as a performer a kind of straight-laced persona, but was a wildly inventive improviser in his own right. And Robin certainly made no bones about admiring him, worshiping him, wanting to sort of proceed in Winters in his mode, Robin talked about seeing his dad react to Winters' jokes and his comedy and laughing at that. And his father for sure was not an easy laugh, and that was something that Robin recognized. He's like, okay, that's something my dad responds to, that's something that makes him happy, and I want to try to emulate that somehow. That's a way that I can reach him, that's how I can connect to him. And that, I think that obviously had a profound impact on him.
I think it's interesting, Dave, the way he is in those early days tape recording late night comedians. Before, obviously, this was before there was any kind of technology much to do. It was pretty basic, and he was doing that, and he was thinking about all of this. But this was before he had decided to become an actor. I mean, he stumbles into this in college at Claremont. We'll get back to that. But I'm wondering, how is he conceiving his life in those early days? He's creative. He's quick. he has an amazing imagination, and that's borne out in these toy soldiers that he plays with. But how does what is he conceiving for his life, do you think, in those earlier days?
Yeah, I think he was still very much figuring himself out. And in a way, he had he certainly had a conservative side to him. I don't mean politically, but just, you know, before the family moved to the Bay Area of California, I mean, for a number of years, he was going to Detroit Country Day School in Michigan. And it's, you know, still runs. And it's not in some ways not unlike the school that you see in Dead Poets Society, at least in the era that Robin attended it. The children all went to classes in blazers and ties. Robin carried a briefcase around with him from class to class. He did very well in, like, rhetoric classes, as you might imagine. And he had he gone on to his senior year there, he had won the election for student class president for that following year. And so, you know, if things had turned out differently, I mean, maybe he could have just gone straight into some kind of, you know, traditional white-collar profession. But then again, before his senior year, his family, for his father takes an early retirement from Ford and moves the family out to Marin County, just north of San Francisco. And they land there in 1969, right at the tail end of the Summer of Love. And it is a wildly different environment than Robin has known before. Totally liberal in all the ways that you can imagine. And even for his first few days at school, he's still going in his jacket
blazer
and tie.
Yeah,
and they're getting these wild looks from these other kids who are like, you have to, you know, I don't know exactly. They probably wouldn't have used this exact language, but they are like, you have to chill out.
Yep.
And that's what he starts to do, that he starts to tap into a much more, you know, permissive culture that he really likes and responds to. And that certainly starts to open him up, even if he, again, hasn't figured out his sort of professional trajectory. That has a pretty substantial effect on his personality.
David Skoff, his book is called Robin. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Want to take full control of how you give to KUER? If you're already a sustainer, you can sign up for MyKUER. You'll be able to update your contact and payment information, make changes to your monthly gift, and even leave us a message. Think of it like getting into the driver's seat. It's up to you where we go. Sign up for MyKUER at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the culture reporter for The New York Times, Dave Itzkoff, about his latest book on Robin Williams. It's called Robin. He just kind of on a whim, it seems, takes an elective course at Claremont. And it's a theater course. And I'm not sure if this is the first time he's starting to think about acting or entertainment, but it was this improv class that he takes that really seemed to kind of set in stone a trajectory for him, I guess.
Yeah, that was another very important turning point or moment for him. That this is, you know, at the school that he's going to, Claremont, is certainly at that time and ongoing. I mean, again, the kind of school that you'd send somebody to if you want them to come out, you know, a CEO or a doctor or a lawyer. And so the elective is almost more to kind of, you know, blow off steam or just try something different. But it was taught by a woman named Dale Morse, who was you know, a very talented improviser and well-known in her own right, and you know, somebody who had, you know, come out of the the Chicago improv scene, and you know, so and you know, Robin, you know, these. I mean, even though he's part of a student troupe that they performed on campus and in other, you know, venues nearby, and they got written up in local papers, not with great reviews, but at least they're, you know, starting to play for audiences. And everybody who is in this group, it was called Karma Pie.
Yeah.
All the alums, I mean, to this day, they acknowledge that Robin was immediately the best member of the group and just seemed to take to it really readily, more so than anybody else, and that already that he had this clear aptitude for it.
What was the gift that he had? It seems like his memory was crazy. And then there's this question that emerges, and it actually happens a few times in the book, this question of whether or not this stuff is really spontaneous as much as it is stuff that he's prepared or he's ready for or that he's been thinking about before. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that that is a kind of push and pull throughout his life and career. I think there is no question that he was a gifted ad libber. He certainly could come up with things in the moment. He was great at that. But there was also a lot of preparation that went into what we think of, I think, as some of his best-known performances and the ones that did involve or seemed to involve a lot of kind of on-the-spot invention that he did do, you know, certainly for all of his, like, big comedy specials or a role like Good Morning Vietnam, a lot of homework and research and learning about that time period and the history and the pop culture of that era when Adrian Cronauer would have been on the air. And he and at the time his assistant, Marsha, who later became his second wife, they spent a lot of time together. Just he would just be riffing in front of her and kind of coming up with, you know, rudimentary bits and lines and characters. And she's, you know, scribbling it all down in notebooks. And then they'd go back and look at the notes and, you know, try to figure out what worked, try to figure out what kind of internal logic or order there was. And then they'd you know, shape the routines accordingly. But that's a process that I think he kind of figured out a little bit later in life. He didn't necessarily have himself that kind of organizational gift or aptitude. And you see often through his professional career, especially, that he needed a kind of a midwife or a second person to provide that to him. He's the one who's just kind of you know, popping off, and then somebody else has to be the one to kind of gather it in a bucket and figure it out.
Yeah. Well, this comes up when he goes to Juilliard. The question of whether or not he is willing or has the capacity to be disciplined enough. But before we get to that moment, there's a really kind of, it seemed like a powerful moment and that revealed something about Robin Williams. He's at Juilliard, of course, and he's in this Pirandello play. And during there's this rehearsal break, and one of his friends, fellow actors, is noticing that Robin, and everyone thinks of him as just social and manic, but he was really keeping to himself. And he's reading the book Ragtime.
Yeah.
Would you tell that story? Because I don't know. I thought that was such an interesting moment, how drawn he was to this section in the book.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because, you know, what he and the other student end up bonding over were the part that Robin points out to him, because the student was reading Ragtime and then it turns out Robin was also reading it, and that's what they kind of connect over. And Robin points him to a passage early in the book that's talking about Harry Houdini.
Yeah.
And explaining him as an escape artist and somebody who over and over puts himself into these impossible situations from which there would seem to be no way out, and yet gets out of it time and time again. And there is certainly, that is a good description, let's say, of the tension that or the anxiety that a stand-up comedian faces night after night. I thought it was a good sort of metaphor for what Robin would encounter later.
Yeah.
But I think it also applies to just how Robin lived his life in general. He couldn't have known it then, but it is such a potent sort of metaphor for Robin himself, this person who keeps escaping situations, who there was so much transition and change in his life, moving from city to city and from family to family.
Yeah.
It would happen later in his life that he would find himself in what would seem to be fairly settled family arrangements with a wife and a child or children, and real, you know, you'd think he's got it all figured out, and then he would do something fairly self-destructive to himself or to the relationship, blow it up, and then divorce the wife. That happened twice, two divorces, and move on to another wife. Just when you think he really was in a place where he could finally be happy.
Yeah. Leaving Juilliard was interesting because this raises this question about his life and his work. And they thought he was talented. I mean, he seemed like he is a prodigy. But in the end, they all agree this is not going to work out. They basically cut him from the program. And this sends his life into another direction. I guess the question was whether or not, and I always wondered about this, even in his film career and just acting in general, did he have the capacity to be disciplined enough to, he could commit to these manic moments in certain, stand-up routines, but could he do it, for bigger roles? That seemed like a kind of a question here.
Yeah, I think at the time that he was in Juilliard, he's only, in his mid-20s. Yeah. I mean, maybe that seems like a point at which, a young actor should have things figured out or have enough self-control. And being 42 now, it seems pretty young. But, the school certainly accepted him, believing that he was somebody who, as you say, had a lot of great raw talent, but he never... he didn't take to the discipline and the regimen of it, and even at Juilliard was a great sort of imitator and of other people's routines and also inventive, but I think for himself found the formality of it. I mean, it is the most sort of classical. Kind of formal acting education you could imagine, and Robin would want to go out on the weekends and perform mime in Central Park or in front of the Metropolitan Museum. I mean, he just wanted to try other modes of expression and just be unconstrained. And we were talking before about these kind of urban myths about his life. There's this persistent story that, after 3 years or so, he and John Houseman get together and Houseman tells him, there's nothing more that this school can teach you. And you've outstripped, all of our educational capacities and you're ready to go out into the world. And that's not really how it went down. It was just a very kind of Darwinian place, certainly under Houseman's jurisdiction, that every year they just cut students who they didn't feel were able to advance further or ready to go on to the next year. And he was among them, that he just left by a kind of mutual decision.
Yeah. Another one of those myths that sort of came up, and it seems like one that Robin himself kind of cultivated, was this idea when he gets his first big break with Mork and Mindy, the sitcom in the 70s.
Yeah.
There's this perception that somehow, as he said during a press conference, about a third of the script is just blank space for me to go off and do what I want. But as the writers sort of said, that's not exactly true. And I'm wondering what you make of that, like him cultivating this idea, some of these ideas, like he was contributing in some ways to his myth in some ways.
Yeah. No, again, that's a perfect example of, because that endures to this day, that people think that, if you pick up a Mork and Mindy script, that you'll see, whole blank chunks or just, a portion where it says Robin does his thing here, and that they just built in space for him to kind of make up scenes. And that's, on the one hand, maybe a compliment to Robin's ad-libbing skills, but kind of a knock on the writers who put in a lot of energy into the show. And yes, he was, given license to kind of figure out his own lines, and they give him multiple takes and they would do rehearsals where he could figure things out. But there's no way that a taped TV show could, operate that way. And it sort of speaks to, certainly when the show became successful, and it was very quick. It was within the first few weeks it was on air. It was a top 10 show and going into, you know, 30 million plus households, which is unthinkable today. And people understood that that had a lot to do with Robin's star power and charisma. And he was, of course, you know, the face of the show, he and Pam Dauber, but primarily him. Mm-hmm. And so that gave him, you know, a certain amount of you know, I mean, that put him on a certain pedestal. And he started to indulge in that, I mean, in a lot of ways. But one of those indulgences was to allow people to think that, yeah, he's really making this up on the fly, and that, it all is sort of hanging on his, you know, a show will live or die based on how well he ad-libs in a given week.
Yeah. It's so, I have to say, it's just remarkable how much of a fluke it was that he got on that show at all. The whole story of how Mork and Mindy comes about, which you lay out in the book, it's basically a conversation between Michael Eisner and Gary Marshall, and ABC doesn't have anything that's really any good. And Eisner says to Marshall, see if you can come up with something. And they come up with Mork and Mindy.
Yeah. And even prior to that, that, you know, the Mork character had first appeared on this kind of random episode of Happy Days.
Yep.
And that came out of a conversation between Gary Marshall and his son, Scotty, who was just a big fan of Star Wars, and said to his dad, I want to see a spaceman on Happy Days. And, you know, the happenstance, the coincidence, you know, the serendipity that they, you know, they were trying at the time to go out to more prominent comic actors. They wanted, say, Dom DeLuise or even Jonathan Winters, and all these people either weren't available or just passed on the role. And so they had to go to somebody who at the time was a little bit lower on the food chain, and that was Robin. And they found in basically a kind of fire sale audition of just bringing in everybody and anybody that they could find, and he was the guy. You know, all these things have to align in just the right way for him to get that show and for it to become the hit that it was.
It flared out fairly quickly in the scheme of things. I mean, it doesn't last very long, show. And why do you think that was? I mean, there was only so far the premise could go. But this seemed like another theme in his career where big expectations, sometimes they don't exactly go where they want. This happened with films, and he's always looking for the right vehicle. And it just a lot of things don't quite live up to the expectation that he thinks there.
Yeah. I think it was certainly one of those lessons that he deeply internalized. The show kind of got tinkered and manipulated with right from the get-go in terms of moving its time slot around, trying to change the format of it to make it more kind of adult and TNA when it was never meant to be that. It was a much more sort of gentle family show, if you will. And the fact that it flamed out so quickly really after four seasons, and in the fourth season, even though Jonathan Winters was on the show at that point, I mean, it really was in a kind of ratings tailspin at that point. And I think the lesson that Robin took away from that was that it certainly reinforced his feeling that the bottom was going to drop out at any moment in terms of his own career, that whatever sort of, good feeling you're enjoying, however much the public or the press likes you, you think you have fans, it's all going to go away at some point, and it's just a matter of when. And maybe that was going to be his one and only hurrah, and there wasn't going to be anything after that that would succeed on that level. He was certainly prepared for that. And then when he did start to have later success, and it took a while really until Good Morning Vietnam was his first, you know, number one box office hit, even in that era and thereafter, he's still kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, that as Mork and Mindy taught him, this is all going to go away at some point.
Yep. Yeah. His experience with the Richard Pryor show is really interesting, and the lessons that he learned there. It seems like we'll talk a little bit about his relationship with Pryor here in a moment, because the level of honesty that he got from Richard Pryor was interesting. But it seems like the lesson he got from that extremely short-lived Richard Pryor show was that you have to at least appeal to the audience, right?
I mean, that because that was such a politically and socially pointed show. It was a sketch series starring Pryor and then a kind of an ensemble of featured players. It would be like if Richard Pryor hosted Saturday Night Live every week and Robin was one of the sort of repertory players on the show. But of course, all the sketches had to do with, you know, social commentary in different ways. And yet they put it on at, you know, 8 o'clock p.m., which was like family viewing time. And nobody wanted, or at least a mass audience was not seeking that at that hour. And
it was like the Chappelle show before America was ready for it.
Certainly, you know, the 8 p.m. viewers of, you know, the year 1977, that's not what they were ready for by any means. And I mean, a lot of the sketches hold up today. There's so, it's wild to see Robin in them because they are so much, you know, they're just so much more pointed than almost anything he would go on to do in his career. And yes, I think he saw, you know, Pryor fight for his own vision and lose in a lot of ways. Yeah. And I think part of what he probably took away from that was the feeling that, you know, you can't I mean, you have to be more flexible, amenable. You might have to give in. I mean, Robin was not somebody who really liked to argue or fight with people.
Yeah.
And yeah, he did not. Even though he had a very strong personal politics, you didn't. You maybe saw them in his stand-up shows, which were one-man routines, but you didn't see them in that direct way in any of his film or TV roles, I would say.
His relationship with Pryor is interesting. One of the things that you write in the book, Richard Pryor, was that Robin Williams could never match Richard Pryor's level of truthfulness. Explain what you mean by
that. Even when I interviewed Robin in 2009, it was something that was still on Robin's mind. That at that point, you know, he had had, you know, he had relapsed into alcoholism and been to rehab. Mm-hmm. He had just gone through his second divorce and then just come through valve replacement, open heart surgery, and all these really, you know, tough scenarios that he was starting to deal with in the stand-up show he was performing at that time. But when I would talk with Robin afterwards, he's still thinking about Richard Pryor as a kind of high watermark in terms of somebody who just put it all out there. His own life was the subject of his routine, and he was unsparing about himself. That even, particularly in the 70s, when Robin best got to know him, and it was, you know, there was no secret that, you know, Pryor was, you know, abusing drugs and alcohol, and his routine certainly dealt with that. And Pryor would talk about that, and that was it. Just, you know, Robin couldn't quite believe that, in a way, that somebody would be that candid about themselves. And it was something he was trying to get to. And I mean, I think there's a, you know, if you look at the trajectory of Robin just as a stand-up, that the earliest stuff, even in the sort of Mork and Mindy era, and it's great, but it's a lot of, you know, character pieces, these kinds of just, you know, he's, you know, the Russian stand-up comedian, or he's a crazy old man, and he'll put those personas on for like 3 to 5 minutes. And it's not for a while before he's really doing comedy that's, you know, at least in some way generated from his own life, or you know, at least tangential to things that he's really experiencing. And then in later years, it does become more personal and a little bit confessional. But, you know, even until, you know, on what would be his last stand-up tour, this Weapons of Self-Destruction, and Robin was telling me, you know, what more can I give an audience besides, you know, open-heart surgery on stage?
Right.
Still, you know, trying to live up to Pryor in that way,
yeah.
I think.
There is a routine that he does at the Roxy in 1978 that I think is worth mentioning, because it seems to reveal. He plays this old man looking back, you know, some, you know, 40 years in the future to 1978 and what people are going to make of a stand-up comic and the stuff that he did. And it seems like then he's really actually thinking about what is the body of my work going to mean in years? And I thought that was pretty interesting for as young as he was to be thinking about it then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's in some ways, it's such a weird piece because, you know, as you start to learn from the character, it's like set after there's been an alien invasion.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's like 30 plus years in the future. And so it's like this old man talking to a fellow survivor of the invasion. And obviously, you know, humanity's been decimated by it in some kind of War of the Worlds way. And you start to realize that this is Robin. You know, the character at that point is supposed to be Robin himself as an old man.
Mm-hmm.
And there, it is in a way him kind of reflecting on or trying to process this idea of what am I going to be like when I'm older, when you know, my body and mind start to you know, give out in certain ways.
Yeah.
And then sadly, you know, the routine then ends up on his first record album called Reality, What a Concept, which is, you know, big, huge hit.
Yeah.
But by then the character had kind of changed and they gave him a name. He was called like Grandpa Funk. So it's not Robin anymore.
Right.
And it was much more just about, you know, he makes these kinds of double entendres and, you know, lewd but funny references. But it's not really about Robin grappling with himself so much. But then many years later, Robin does this bit on Saturday Night Live. This is in like 1988, where – so again, I mean, he's not even, you know, 40 years old yet, but he plays himself as an old man. He's like 60 and living by himself in a small apartment, and his fans have deserted him, and he's not popular anymore, and he's kind of grumpy. And, you know, it's played for laughs. It's not like a tearjerker in any way. But again, it's this – you know, it's him – trying to reckon with or imagine or think about what the future looks like for him. And it always seems to end in his mind with, you know, this kind of collapse and that people retreating from him and him, you know, losing whatever it is that he had that made him great.
You write about his last days and how I think a lot of us obviously were just stunned that this had happened. No one had any sense of what was really going on. And he had had this diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. And then we get this, and we'll talk about this here in a moment, the Lewy body disease that comes out after the autopsy and a sense of what's really going on. But talk a little bit about the last year or so, maybe we can talk, because he's having delusions. He doesn't think he can be – there are moments, these bursts of paranoia, and he doesn't think he can – be funny anymore. Looking back on it, that there's some sort of medical condition, it makes sense, but it must have been incredibly despairing for him and confusing.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad. I mean, it's sad for so many reasons, and you know, it's sad that at that point, I mean, he had already kind of lost a lot of faith in himself. That you know, in 2013 he had starred on a CBS sitcom called The Crazy Ones, which was sort of his attempt at a TV comeback, and it was really not well received, and it was you know, canceled in pretty short order. And he certainly, you know, I mean, he wasn't, I think, quite as you know, I mean, later on people would sort of say, well, was that the reason that he took his own life? And it was not quite that direct, but certainly that was something that wounded him.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, he had been experiencing, I think, a lot of rejection. But then what was, you know, happening to him physically at that point, you know, really went beyond, you know, what was happening inside of his own mind and his brain. And he wasn't totally aware of that, nor were the people around him. You know, his makeup artist told me a story from when they were making The Last Night at the Museum movie, which is the last feature-length film that he would appear in.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, he felt like he was having a lot of trouble remembering his lines. They're shooting in Vancouver, and he didn't like to even go outside of his hotel room when he wasn't working. And his makeup artist was encouraging him, you know, just try to go to one of the stand-up clubs here. Just make a surprise appearance. Just pop in. You'll see how much, you know, people love and miss you. And Robin just broke down in her arms in tears as she tells the story that he says to her, I can't be funny anymore.
Yeah.
And that's must have been such a horrible thing to hear someone like him say. And, you know, that confluence of, you know, him starting to, I think, recognize, you know, or be aware of a kind of, you know, physical, you know, problems, biological problems he's having. But also, again, that you know, that real sort of undermining of his own confidence that he had been putting himself through.
There's that big question. You write in the book that, you know, the recent months in Robin Williams' life had been suffused with this anguish, but he had given no explicit indication to anyone that he wished to end his life. Although you do tell the story that he has this interaction with Dana Carvey at the Throckmorton Theater, where he seems to be kind of making amends or something. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few, you know, comedians and friends from, you know, people who knew him in those last weeks and months of his life who do kind of look retrospectively his interactions with them and do feel that maybe in some way or another he was trying to make some kind of, you know, final accounting or getting things right with them while he still could. The story that Carvey tells is that, you know, he runs into Robin late at night on this, outside this kind of small theater in Mill Valley. And, you know, Robin wants to apologize to him for what Robin perceives as basically, you know, stealing a piece of Carvey's material. And Carvey, you know, it basically says, you didn't take this from me. That's not mine. And but later, Carvey understanding like that what he should have said or felt he should have said in the situation was, you know, give Robin the room to do that and you know allow him permission to do that. Certainly, I mean, in the police report from that was filed after Robin's death, that they found no evidence on his computer, let's say, of searches for methods of suicide as might happen, and there was no we're not aware that there was any kind of suicide note which might there was no evidence of like what they would call suicidal ideation. So that's. And I think also once you come to understand the specific condition that he was suffering from at the time, which you mentioned, Lewy body disease, which is that attacks not only the motor parts of the brain, which would lead to symptoms that are similar to Parkinson's disease, which Robin was given a diagnosis of, but it also attacks parts of the brain that control reasoning and judgment and just how you process information. And, there's not a way to know for certain either way, but whether Robin really in his final, moments, does he clearly understand, who he is, what he's doing to himself? Was this something that he had pre-planned or was it just a horrible impulse that he had that he followed through on?
A friend of his, Rick Overton, said that there's no way he would have abandoned his family in his right mind. So was he cognizant? That's one of the big questions. And as you say, there's no way of knowing that. Bobcat Goldthwait says something that I thought was interesting that you mentioned in the book, that Robin Williams died from Lewy body dementia, but that the world wanted it to be about something else. That they wanted to think that he died because of depression or for drugs or because of relationships. Talk a little bit about that. What do you think that's about?
Yeah. Well, I it's understandable that I think in the immediate time period after his death and as the world learns about it, that there wasn't a lot of information other than the specific circumstances. I mean, terribly hard for his family to deal with, and not an easy. The family is learning about it in real time, and that's not. It doesn't make it easy to then go out and say, "Okay, here's what happened, and here's what we know." They're dealing with it just as private people, and so in that kind of vacuum, and for a few days, a lot of people, understandably, just kind of drew their own conclusions, connected their own dots, and because it was known that he had had depression in the past, people assumed that that was what was going on, or they made the conclusion that he must have been really disappointed with the state of his career at that point, or he had money problems, which was not the case, but that's what some people assumed, and. A sad silver lining, I think, is that it did open up this whole kind of larger conversation about mental health and people wanting to be either open to each other about what they might themselves have been going through, or be aware of people around you, make yourself available to people in case they're having these kinds of problems. Even in a few days after Robin's death, his widow put out a statement acknowledging that he had been given that Parkinson's diagnosis. And so I think a lot of people, again, it seemed to reinforce the theory that it was, you know, the taking of his life was something that he did actively and knowingly and deliberately in that way, that he didn't want to see himself deteriorate. So therefore, you know, he took this action. And again, it wasn't for many months after, until after his autopsy was completed and released. And the you know, they did in the course of that analyze his brain tissue and found the evidence of what was likely Lewy body disease. But because it was so many months later, I think either people already felt like they knew what had happened. They'd drawn their own conclusions. There just wasn't, you know, certainly there wasn't the global focus in the way that his death had brought up. And so I think a lot of people just did not get that piece of information and just were never aware that that's what had happened.
Yeah.
And so I think, again, even, you know, even to this day, I think there are still a lot of people that believe, well, you know, he killed himself because of depression or you know, again, in this kind of deliberate, you know, way.
Let me ask you this finally. You say for all the strands of culture that Robin had tied together in his work and all the people that he drew from, all the inspirations that he took from different places, that really there is not an actor or a comedian who could be considered his heir right now, who's, I guess, anything like him or is going to continue that kind of work. Do you think that's true?
I mean, I certainly think it's true of right now. It doesn't sort of rule out the possibility of there, you know, maybe being somebody else who is, you know, either as an actor has his kind of, you know, empathy and love of humanity and is open in that way, or as a comedian, just somebody who is so wildly, you know, improvisational and free form in the way that he was. I think that latter aspect, I think, would be so hard to duplicate right now, partly because that's just not where comedy is. Yeah. You know, and as an art form, it changes and the pendulum swings back and forth. But I think also if somebody were to step out on a stage and do that now, they would almost immediately be accused of being a Robin Williams imitator. And that would be very hard to kind of get out from underneath from. So I think that might even discourage people from wanting to try to perform that way. And so it's just, again, as I said, it doesn't mean that it can never happen, that nobody might, there won't be a person who's like him, but because he's so unique and sui generis, you know, it's sort of like saying, well, why isn't there another Charlie Chaplin? Just because Chaplin was Chaplin and Robin Williams was Robin Williams. I don't know that there could ever, somebody couldn't, you know, combine all those facets and aspects into a single person.
Dave Itzkoff is a culture reporter for The New York Times. His latest book is called Robin. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.